Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports 380 confirmed and probable cases of vaping-related lung illnesses in 36 states. At least 7 people, including a California resident this week, have died. No single substance or product has been pinpointed as a cause, but most patients said they were using e-cigarettes with THC, the chemical in marijuana that creates the high. Jane O'Donnell reports on healthcare policy for USA Today. She's been covering the story. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
So a lot of them are reporting using the vaping instrument to inhale THC. And it's not, the suggestion here is not that the THC in and of itself is creating the problem, but that who's ever bootlegging these things is has other, there's something else in there that's causing the problem.
Right. Yes, that's the belief. Although it is important to note that some of the cases do involve cannabis products that were purchased at dispensaries, so it may not be bootlegged, but it was somehow contaminated.
At least 7 people had died. What is the illness? What do we know about it? What's it doing?
Well, it's making it very difficult to breathe. It's called, I believe, vaping-induced lung illness. It's often a variety of forms of pneumonia, often lipid pneumonia, which is caused by the lipids, which are, I'm learning a lot about chemistry,
yeah, right.
Which is kind of fats and oils that are in some of the things that things that are being used to cut, to dilute the THC oil. And the vitamin E acetate is a thing that's been focused on by federal and state investigators. And that kind of, it attaches to the lungs and makes breathing increasingly difficult. But, it starts with all sorts of problems. Like, I'm working on yet another story right now and, describing one young person had a lot of vomiting, fever, sweating. So you feel like you're getting the flu and show up at the hospital, and in one case, this particular case, the young man didn't have, his x-ray didn't show anything, but at first, like on a Saturday night, mm-hmm. but within a day or two, it was very cloudy, and he went downhill very fast.
People have been using vaping pens to inhale THC for years now. This isn't a new thing. Is there so when we're talking about those 380 cases of this vaping related lung illness in 36 states, is that between what and what? What time? What's the time frame here?
Those are pretty recent in the last couple of years, but you raise a very good point. I had a round and round conversation with an editor a couple of weeks ago because he kept saying, since when? Because he couldn't believe there was only 5 deaths. I'm like, well, there probably were more deaths. I think he had seen so much of this in the news. But there is something going on, and I'm working on like the why now piece of the story right now, and it's a variety of factors that are combining to cause this now. There's so many more young people vaping, and they're doing it so much more. So they're starting with nicotine, but within very little time, in many cases, they're going to THC, and they may not have even purchased. Well, they wouldn't have purchased in many cases unless they're 18, and mm-hmm. in some cases now they have to be 21. They wouldn't have purchased it legally to begin with, so they have some sort of kind of knockoff device, perhaps knockoff cartridges. And then they're making the leap into the knockoff THC. The studies do show they're 3.5 times more likely to try marijuana if they are vaping nicotine.
How is the CDC responding?
I personally found it interesting, and the first story that I did, I pointed out, my colleague and I pointed out what the criticism was early on, because I looked at it. I have a 19-year-old daughter who I'm told by her doesn't vape, but I know that most of her friends do at college. It's very, very common, and while I was very alarmed as a parent to learn that so many high school students were vaping and becoming addicted to nicotine, it really wasn't what was sending the vast majority, at least 80%, at least 80% of the cases also involve THC, and all of the ones that have been really well researched involve THC. So I think based on the research and the critics that I spoke to early on, there was a missed opportunity to be very clear about the warnings early on. They kept warning and continue in some cases to warn against all vaping,
right,
which nobody thinks is good. But if you're a parent, what you really need to be worried about is your child vaping marijuana products? Where are they getting them? Marijuana is very dangerous for young people, for their developing brains anyway, and their mental health. But then there's a lung illness they could be getting. But so CDC is now they're throwing a lot of resources at it, and they're being more clear about THC being a big focus of it. But it wasn't the early way they were warning. Mm.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the 380 confirmed and probable cases of vaping-related lung illness in 36 states. There are also 7 people have died, including a California resident, this week. My guest is Jane O'Donnell. She reports on healthcare policy for USA Today. She's been covering the story. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So when you've written about how these vaping illnesses have highlighted flawed marijuana regulations, that's what you're talking about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's just so little regulation. Even the companies that I'm speaking to are more or less begging for regulation. And that's not usually the case. I've been a Washington reporter since the 80s, and you don't usually see, it's very rare that you see companies saying they want more regulation, because they're being tarred by this as well. Because, you know, if they're doing the right thing, but there really isn't, like, they might say, a state, for example, might say, you have to, vitamin E acetate is not an approved ingredient, but it's also not banned,
mm-hmm.
and you just have to put it on your label. So that kind of thing, where something that's known to be dangerous can get in and not be literally breaking the law.
The Food and Drug Administration this week warned nicotine vaping industry giant Juul to stop making claims that the country's products are safer than smoking tobacco. So what does a warning mean in this context?
Oh, well, it doesn't really hold much.
That's
it doesn't
what I
hold much weight, but I think they're being a lot more careful, because they really did. There were a lot of mistakes early on, with a lot of aggressive marketing. It really is just kind of, it doesn't carry the weight of law, but they really need to be careful, and they are being careful, but they're being, the former Food and Drug Administration chief Scott Gottlieb says that these two things are being conflated, that it just happens that we're hearing about all these lung illnesses, and the government found out that the rate of their early analysis of the data for 2018 shows that high school kids, it went from 20% of them had tried vaping nicotine in the last 30 days to 27%. So they're really reacting to that more than these lung illnesses. But they're trying to make sure young people don't get the false impression that it's safe to vape.
Right. The Trump administration proposed a ban on flavored vaping products, and that is, again, that's what you're talking about. It doesn't really have anything to do necessarily with the problem at hand.
Right.
For those who don't know, what is vaping? If I vape, what am I putting in my lungs? Because you are inhaling it, right?
Yes, you are inhaling it, and it's, and in the case of nicotine, it's a liquid, not an oil, which gets into some of the riskier things in some respects. But it's a vaporized form of nicotine. It's going right into your lungs. You can have flavors that's believed to add risk. It also makes it easier for people to quit smoking who are older. And there's, as you've probably noticed, a very big push by the tobacco and vaping industries. The tobacco industry, it's important to note, is now owns a third of Juul.
Yeah.
And that's led to a lot of the negative press, so to speak, against vaping. I'm not judging whether it's right or wrong, but I think those are important things to note here.
And then, as far as when people vape, do they tend to vape as much as they would have smoked cigarettes before? Is there been any studies
more
on that? More.
Yeah, more, because they can get away with it. I mean, it's gotten a lot riskier. I mean, they've clamped down on young people doing it in high school, and a lot of places have.
Yeah, a district here is buying detectors now.
Yeah. They can still, I mean, the kids do it in the bathroom, mm-hmm. and you know, these devices are so tiny. The ones that were started with could often be the size of a cell phone, and now they're the size of, I don't know, like a pen, frankly, a flat pen. And that's what I found most alarming when I first started writing about this about a year ago. It happened to be last summer, and I was working with a lot of college interns, and they were telling me how it was just everywhere, that you would, and they went to some of the best colleges in the country, and mm-hmm. you walk into the library, and it was just a big haze, like everyone was sitting there vaping. So they're vaping, some of these kids, and they get very anxious if they don't do it.
They are definitely addicted to the nicotine.
Oh, yeah, yes. And I cover addiction, and the some of the addiction medicine doctors say it is the hardest thing for them to get people off of. You know, the heroin pills, or benzodiazepines, alcohol, but it's the tobacco that's the hardest for them to quit.
Is there any evidence that vaping nicotine makes it more addictive? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think.
Well,
partly because there's more nicotine, you can take in a lot more nicotine.
Okay.
I mean, some of these devices have like 50% nicotine. I mean, that's higher than a lot of people are going to have in their cigarettes.
And they're vaping more than people.
Vaping more often, right? And child psychologists I interviewed described how kids are just so anxious after, you know, when they try to quit. One young girl went on vacation with her parents and couldn't vape because she was around them so mm-hmm. much, and she was just a basket case, not being able to do it, you know, headaches and irritability, mm-hmm. that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a former smoker. 30 years ago, I quit, and mm-hmm. I know about all of that. I couldn't write.
And people say, and you could relate to this, I mean, I actually quit drinking myself 27 years ago, and I had a friend who had quit drinking before me, and he had more trouble quitting smoking because he said he associated it with more parts of the day.
Exactly.
Even at the worst, he didn't wake up and have a drink. You know, he didn't have to have a drink after every meal, mm-hmm. that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a tough thing. And, you know, and what's sad, and I cover public health, is that it's a reversal. It threatens to reverse the really great public health successes we've had as a society, bringing the smoking rate down. And so, I mean, that when you have young people that were some of the ones least likely to have started smoking becoming addicted to nicotine, that's scary.
Who is regulating the industry? Is it the FDA or
yes.
nobody? Okay.
Yeah, when it comes to, but we're talking about the nicotine there. So FDA has authority over.
Are we still there?
Jane? Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The FDA has authority over what?
The tobacco products.
Okay.
And there really is, like, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, is over marijuana, but there's all sorts of gray areas. Like, literally, this sounds nonsensical to even say, but CBD became CBD, which we didn't even really talk about, but
right.
there's been tainted versions of CBD that had synthetic marijuana in it. But according to the FDA, it's not legal to sell. But on the other hand, the farm bill opened the floodgates for it, and they're now you're allowed to sell hemp products, mm-hmm. which CBD is, across state lines. You're allowed to make it and sell it. So there's so many gray areas here. It is scary. And you know, when you think about, we all have our things we feel more or less scared about, but there's a lot of suspicion and skepticism about pharmaceuticals and prescription antidepressants, but there's a lot of testing that goes into that. And people are, in many cases, turning away from that because they think, well, this is natural. Well, it's not natural given all these pesticides and who knows what has gone into it.
Well, Jean O'Donnell, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
Jean O'Donnell's a healthcare policy reporter for USA Today, and she's been covering the issue of the cases of vaping-related lung illnesses in 36 states, as well as many other issues involving the vaping trend. We will continue Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Mental health and physical health often are considered separate wellness issues, but the World Health Organization defines health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being. Mental Health America of Franklin County is offering a free program to merge the two topics. Tanya Fulwider is the Associate Director of Mental Health America of Franklin County. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. Great to chat.
Let's talk about the connection between mental health and physical health. Why is this an issue?
Well, because thanks for asking. Because people with mental illnesses, particularly severe mental illnesses, severe depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, have a significantly higher rate of early death. So the lifespan is between 10 and 25 years earlier than the general population. Like you were just talking about, smoking and how the rates have gone down. But in people with mental illnesses, they still have smoking rates at a higher rate. There are higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of cardiovascular risks. So, addressing the additional barriers that people with mental illnesses have to their physical health is really what the program works on.
What about the additional barriers? What are the barriers?
Well, people with mental illnesses, even if they're getting their illness treated, oftentimes face additional health complications. Now, if you're taking a psychiatric medication, that may cause weight gain. Mm. And then what do you choose, right? So do you choose to address your mental illness? But then how does that impact your physical health? And how can we support, addressing your physical health and these factors that cause an earlier loss of life in people with mental illnesses? So there's that. There's just other barriers that people with mental illnesses face of accessing treatment and understanding how to address, not just what your psychiatric illness might be, but how do you get the care to make sure that you're not at an increased risk for heart disease or that, what other complications might be present because you're trying to deal with your mental illness.
Hmm. Is there a sense or when physicians or psychiatrists prescribe psychiatric drugs, do they do a good enough job explaining to their patients what the side effects can be and how to address those side effects?
Yeah, that's a tricky question because I certainly don't want to to throw anyone under the bus that is providing psychiatric treatment. But it's complicated because there's such a wide range of side effects. I mean, anyone that's been prescribed a psychiatric medication knows by the time you fill it, you've got a novel of everything that can possibly happen to you. And there's so many different treatments. Oftentimes the stigma associated with getting treatment around mental illness, it's like there's this delicate balance of explaining all the possible side effects and what you can do, but then you also don't want to scare someone away from actually getting a treatment that they need. There are systemic issues of does a primary care provider or even a psychiatrist, do they have time to truly educate someone on all the ways that they can address their physical health when treatment with mental health?
And also the issue of physical health and how it intersects with mental health isn't necessarily something that is covered with your healthcare insurance or something like that. So say you're going to gain weight from a medication. One way to combat that would be to be to do workout, to do exercise, to be in a, but that's not covered by a prescription.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's challenging for all of us, right? It's challenging.
Yeah.
It's not just people with mental illness that it's hard to exercise or it's hard to eat a healthy diet. But then, when you add those additional complications on there of battling depression or battling anxiety or bipolar disorder, and then trying to access healthy habits. And that's right. I mean, if you want to get into something that like a gym or an exercise class, that's expensive. It's not all often covered by, various health plans. And, our healthcare system doesn't necessarily work with us on that from any standpoint. There is just it can be challenging to address that. So, what we try to do is with this program really help people figure out ways that they can be physically healthy in the context of struggling with a mental illness and kind of bring those things together.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking with Tanya Fulwider. She's the Associate Director of Mental Health America of Franklin County. And we're talking about the intersection of mental and physical health. Healthy Connections is a free 6-week program that Mental Health America of Franklin County is putting on. It helps people learn how to manage physical health when dealing with mental illness. You can check out the link on the website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information about that. Again, it's a free 6-week program to help you manage physical health when dealing with mental illness. Tell us about this program. It's free. It's open to the public. What was the tipping point? Why did you decide to do this?
Well, this program's actually been around for a little over 10 years, and it was the impetus. So our organization, a lot of our programs sort of focus on addressing gaps in care. So, whether it's a support group or whether it's, access to free counseling or navigating the mental health system. And what really came about was this staggering discrepancy in life expectancy, that people with mental illnesses, particularly severe mental illnesses, have anywhere from a 10 to 25 year life expectancy reduction compared to the rest of the population. And what these studies found was that a lot of things were largely preventable with lifestyle changes. They were, obesity and, heart health and managing diabetes and, nutrition and active living. So that was the impetus was, what can we do to, help people who are struggling with mental illness address their physical health? It's complicated to get treatment for any kind of illness for a lot of us. But then when you're trying to, get treatment for an illness that also impacts our physical health, well, then what do we do? So it was just the idea of how can we get people together, provide a free program that can help them set some goals to address the things that their mental illness is impacting on their physical health.
And it's a 2-hour class. What happens during that 2 hours?
Well, so it's it's an educational session, but of course, it's not like school. It's a group, and it focuses on people getting to know each other and connect, right? So healthy connections, and then connected goals. The beginning is thinking about what are your physical health issues and how can we work within the next 6 weeks to try to give you all the tools that we can to meet those goals. So setting that, right, that SMART, lots of people use that SMART acronym of specific and measurable, attainable, relevant, time-based, setting a goal at the beginning. And then each session is wrapped around peer support, which we know is effective. It's wrapped around different curriculum, so talking about heart health and diabetes and healthy sleep and stress management, nutrition, active living, all in the context of helping you achieve your goal in a supportive environment with people of your peers.
And the kind of people, what have you learned from the folks who attend these sessions over the years?
Well, we've learned a lot of what we expected, which is that it's really challenging. The healthcare system is difficult for people to navigate, and people with mental illnesses, it's especially difficult to navigate. So if we're navigating our mental illness successfully, how do we help people figure out how to navigate their physical health and how do we bring those things together? And it's really, really difficult. So people are very much challenged by that. People are challenged by not, just like you were talking about earlier, understanding that their weight gain isn't a failure, but it's a side effect and how of a medication and how can we address that weight gain is not a personal failure, but yet something that we can try to work on. We've learned that there's a lot of education people don't have as to how do you decide what healthy eating is for you and how can you attain that, in your budget and in your lifestyle and how you feel every day. What does active living actually mean? How much exercise do you need? Do you actually need to join a gym or are there things that you can do to be physically healthy outside of that? So each thing is really each session is really about getting in the context of that person's life and then helping them meet those goals from there.
Do you have any success stories you can talk about, people who were able to tip the scale in their favor health-wise and still grapple with their mental illness effectively?
Oh, absolutely. Well, so in addition to having a social worker that leads the class or the sessions, we also have two peer supporters who attend the class as well. So they've been through the program. Mm-hmm. And, one of those peer supporters, struggled with severe depression, went through the class twice. And then now is one of those peer supporters that attends the class. He lost a lot of weight, 80 pounds, just in implementing some of the things that were in the class, and then has now gone on to help continue, and has for, gosh, probably 6 or 7 years, has continued to work with the agency to help people in the context of their severe depression. How can they address some of these challenges? And even when relapse happens, right? Mm-hmm. If a period of depression, what do you do? What are the steps there? So the program is really built also around people, having successes and then being able to share them as participants in the program too.
It's a 6-week program. Do you have to attend all 6 sessions?
So, in order to graduate, so to speak, you need to attend 4 of the sessions.
Okay.
But what I will say is that we're actually shifting the program in 2020 to be a rolling 8-week session. Hmm. And so basically it'll be available all the time. And you'll be able to, anytime 4 times of the month, be able to show up and attend any of the sessions in order to complete. So we're actually shifting to have more availability and growing the program in 2020. So it will look similar in that the content will be the same, the curriculum will be the same, but there'll be a lot more opportunities to complete the curriculum.
And like you said, one of the presenters for the program went back twice to it. It's not something mm-hmm. that it's as long as you need to keep going to it for the help.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, again, we all can use support around goal setting. I mean, I can use support around goal setting. I can certainly use support around active living mm-hmm. or, stress management. So there's this opportunity to continue to, once you're familiar with that, and if something really connects with you, maybe it is, mindfulness, and there are things on mindful eating or emotional eating. What's that mean? Mm-hmm. what does it mean for emotional eating? And maybe that's something that you need to refresh on, so you can continue to go through the program when you feel like you need it.
Is there any sense, like, I know some people who, I work out because it helps my mental health.
Uh-huh.
It's a stress reliever and a lot of other things. I just feel better mentally. Is there any sense that for some, I don't want to oversimplify this. I know it's complicated, but people who work on physical health help improve their mental health outcomes.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's the science behind addressing your physical health, being active, and that impacting your mental health. There's all kinds of data that shows that's a thing that you. But what a lot of people don't necessarily know is how much, right? How much do you need to go and lift weights? Do you need to become a runner in order to be mentally healthy?
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't. So that's a lot of what this course will do is talk. What kinds of exercise can you do in your life that will help your mental health, but still feel, attainable. That's where a lot of, there's sometimes a lot of myths around, and that will sometimes, prohibit people from getting started. Well, I don't have an hour to go exercise. Well, do you have 10 minutes? What mm-hmm. can you do in 10 minutes that can help impact your physical and mental health? What do you need to get that serotonin moving in your brain in order to help you feel better. And that looks different for people, but it is absolutely, and that's why active living is included in the course, is because we do know that exercise does impact mental health, but it's hard for, it's hard for lots of people to get started, but it's certainly hard for people who are struggling with depression or bipolar disorder, or other ways, things that get in the way.
Tanya Fulwider, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Sure. It was my pleasure. Thanks, Ann.
Tanya Fulwider is the Associate Director of Mental Health America of Franklin County. They're putting on a free 6-week program. It's called Healthy Connections, and it helps people learn how to manage physical health when dealing with mental illness. So check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides for more information. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 40 million adults in the U.S. can't afford or access health care. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Marty McCary has explained why health care is so expensive in his new book. It's titled The Price We Pay, What Broke American Health Care and How to Fix It. Dr. McCary is a surgical oncologist and professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Anne.
This is nothing new, this topic. It's just recycled constantly now, healthcare costs and access. And the U.S., it's been an issue for years and years. What was the tipping point? When did it become so tough and so expensive?
You're right. It's been a gradual growth of this giant medical industrial complex But, you know, I've learned in doing all this research around healthcare costs that the reason healthcare costs so much is an issue that nobody is talking about, that we need to start talking about, and that is pricing failures. Pricing failures, middlemen, and inappropriate care are the real drivers of healthcare costs being so unaffordable. And it's not what the politicians or cable news are really presenting to us. They talk about different ways to finance the broken healthcare system. Mm-hmm. We need to talk about how to fix it.
We've had lots of programs about pharmacy benefit managers, for example, the middlemen in the pharmaceutical business, because the story broke largely out of the Columbus Dispatch. They've done an incredible series of stories over the last year and a half or so about it. But it's complicated to even talk about it.
It is. And, you know, the independent consultant who was hired, brought into Ohio to take a look at that, I talked to him and in doing the research for this book. And
Are you there? Dr. McCurry?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. You said that you brought you were just referring to the consultant that was brought into Ohio to talk about that.
Yeah, I talked to him and he said, you know, I told him they're wasting all this money, but they didn't really believe me. And it took another consulting group to really point out these money games. Most businesses are getting ripped off on their pharmacy plans or their health insurance. And so I try to point out how businesses can navigate better benefits for their beneficiaries and employees.
NPR has been doing a series on surprise bills. I think it's All Things Considered. You might have heard of it. Maybe it's once a month or so, and they have somebody give an experience of surprise bills. Why can't we find out what we're going to pay for something?
That's a pretty incredible series, and I do follow that and even interact with some of those patients that get these egregious, crazy bills. You know, it's ironic that American hospitals are the center of scientific genius. Mm-hmm. But we can't even give you a price. I mean, imagine if airlines billed us after the flight, and they would be gouging all over. If we didn't have a travel website with prices, and they can build in into the price the sort of risk or the predictability of that care. You know, if airlines told us they can't give us a price because they don't know if the flight could be canceled or you might consume a beverage on the flight, we would say, no, you can build in that predictability into the price, and we have a coherent marketplace. But in healthcare, the nebulousness, the lack of showing prices, enables price gouging and predatory billing, which, as a physician, I can tell you, threaten the great public trust in the medical profession today. And what I learned is that there's a movement now for price transparency and ways patients can navigate and learn prices.
You highlight a hospital in Carlsbad, New Mexico, that had the practice of hiking prices and suing patients who were unable to pay. What did you find there?
So I found that this hospital, one of about 10% of hospitals in the sample that we studied, aggressively sue patients who can't afford their bills and then try to garnish their paychecks. I met these folks. They're waitresses. They're single moms. These are people with insurance. They've done nothing wrong, except they're the casualty of this massive game that that hospitals and insurers play, which is inflating bills and then offering secret discounts. I go to court as their pro bono expert, and I defend them. We win 100% of the time. I tell the judge, Your Honor, I can't show up and mow your lawn and send you a bill for $4,000 without a contract. There needs to be civility. And look, I'm a surgeon. When you need trauma surgery, we're not going to give you a price, okay? But most of medical care is elective and predictable and shoppable. 60% of all medical services are shoppable. And the new movement to create price transparency is alive and well. There are many tools people can use, from MD Save to Clear Health Costs to FairHealth.org. I even was told at that Carlsbad Medical Center, where we're, by the way, trying to get them to stop suing patients, just as we did at other hospitals in America, we asked them to stop suing patients, and two hospitals have already responded. One had sued 24,000 people in a town of 28,000 by census. We're reminding them why we went into medicine and to have some mercy. But this one person at Carlsbad Medical Center at the radiology counter was standing at the desk, and I said, if I would like a CAT scan, how much would it cost? And she said, about $5,000. And then she basically whispered to me, but if you go on this website, mdsave.com, you can get it for $500 at the same hospital here. We list our prices on that website on a competitive playing field.
When you say shoppable, that's one thing, but say I'm in an insurance group that has limits on where I can go and who I can see.
Well, by the way, not everyone will use pricing information if it's available. Some people may choose the more expensive care if they're not paying. But proxy shoppers drive the marketplace. Hmm. When I don't look at prices when I shop at the grocery store, but my mom does, and her friends price compare, and this fraction of people who do price shop keep markets in check for all of us. Insurers and employers are your proxies, and they're shopping based on price, but they're dealing with this nebulous secrecy just like everyone else. So many services are shoppable. I mean, look at the parts of healthcare that already have total price transparency: IVF treatments, LASIK eye surgery, cosmetic surgery. In all those areas, we've seen a global reduction in prices over time, whereas the rest of healthcare has had a massive inflation of prices over time.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Marty McCary. He's a surgical oncologist at Johns Hopkins University, and he also teaches medical public policy. He has written a new book. It's titled The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Talks about the driving forces behind rising healthcare costs. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You write a lot also, you write a lot about what hospitals are doing wrong, but you also highlight the many hospitals that are doing something right or trying to do the right thing, correct?
Yeah, we're reminding hospitals of their great mission and of their our great medical heritage. You know, most hospitals were built to be a safe haven for the sick and injured in the community. Many of them were built by churches. They had a charter dedicating them to serve their communities. And there's an incredible medical heritage in the medical profession. Doctors and nurses historically take care of people regardless of their background or ability to pay. That's our great medical heritage. And that's what we need to remember in this mass business of medicine loaded with money games. And it's gotten so bad to the point where 1 in 5 Americans now has medical debt in collections. We can do better. We need to cut through the money games and restore medicine to its mission.
You talk about avoidable care and point out that our Western medicine traditions now automatically look to prescribing medication versus lifestyle changes.
You know, one of the things I love about being at a university is the young folks. They have an open mind to new things. And we're seeing a whole generation of people who are demanding honesty, not just with billing practices, but with bedside care. I mean, I highlight the work of relationship-based medicine, this new movement, which is now saying, hey, can we treat abdominal pain with healthy foods? Can we talk about treating diabetes with cooking classes? Can we manage more patients with back pain with physical therapy and ice instead of surgery and opioids?
Mm-hmm.
This is the movement to restore medicine back to its great bedside art of listening to patients, being honest with what we know and don't know, and encouraging people to live great lifestyles that prevent illness.
Pediatrics is another plays a role in all of this. What's going on there?
In pediatrics?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a new movement now to say we learn in medical school the diagnosis and treatment pairs for everything, but we need to talk about the appropriateness of care. I mean, did you know that many patients with small cavities do not need a drilling and a filling? Silver diamine fluoride is extremely effective in treating cavities. The only downside is it can slightly darken the tooth. But if the tooth is coming out anyway.
Yeah, if it's a baby tooth, right, yeah.
Yeah, or if you don't care, you can't see the tooth and the part of the mouth, or you're older and don't care, like I don't care, then guess what? People prefer a little drop instead of having a drilling. And this is the movement to talk about appropriateness in medicine. I'm a surgeon. You don't need to treat appendicitis with surgery. 75% of the time. This is the new science of appropriateness.
What about insurance and the role of insurance? So is a typical dental insurance company going to cover the $109 for the silver diamine fluoride drop compared to the drilling, much more expensive?
No, we have a totally messed up and perverted system that promotes doing stuff when the right thing may be to do less or to do a more cost-effective treatment. I know surgeons who truly believe that adopting the medical management of appendicitis model based on the new science is a big threat to their revenue and to the quotas that they're put under. But you know what? Healthcare has grown into a massive business where it last year became the largest industry in the United States. I'm not sure that's something to be proud of. Hospitals have been there for their communities. It was never designed to be this massive industry with 30% of it going to sort of the back repricing industry and middle management and waste. We've got good people working in American hospitals and in businesses that drive healthcare innovation and new models of delivering care. But let's be honest, we have created a massive industry. Look at medications. Over the last 10 years, we have prescribed double the medications than we have 10 years ago. So we have a crisis of appropriateness. The opioid epidemic was just one medication that was overprescribed. There are many more. We need to talk about appropriateness in healthcare.
You make the point. Now, I have to admit that I've never had the LASIK surgery done on my eyes because it got to be so affordable. I thought, well, how do I know it's going to be good? And you say there is no correlation between surgery price and quality.
Well, in the markets where we've looked at secret pricing, we found no correlation. A researcher at the University of Iowa called 100 hospitals that do heart surgery and asked, what's the price for the standard heart CABG procedure? Only half of those hospitals could give him a price after he haggled with them. Of those that gave him a price, the price ranged from $44,000 to $500,000. He then looked at the outcomes in the national registry and found no correlation between quality, and there's also been found to be no correlation with charity care. So people need to know that it's the Wild West, and you should look up the reference-based price when you go to negotiate your bills. One of the little-known secrets in healthcare is that you can negotiate your bills.
Can you drill down any deeper into that, though? Because, you know, we've all heard the horror stories about the, you know, $50 a tablet for an aspirin kind of a thing, to find out where the costs are coming from.
Well, sure. It's a series of money games, including kickbacks among middlemen called rebates in the PBM space. Trust me, those rebates are not like rebates on cornflakes. These are kickbacks, and they are enabled by a 1987 law by Congress that allowed them to be exempt from the anti-kickback statutes. I personally believe, as a physician, and I love my job, we should not have any kickbacks in healthcare. We should not have any secrecy and secret pricing in healthcare. We need to create honesty in medicine again.
And is that something that has to be done at the legislative level, do you think?
No, two different places for us to do something. And we've got instructions at restoringmedicine.org, where we also have 20 tips on how to negotiate your medical bills. I get into these issues in the book, but basically, while we talk to the policymakers, many of whom are bought by the special interest, to be very honest with you, but we need to talk to them. They need to hear from us. At the same time, businesses can make smarter decisions, renegotiate their PBM and pharmacy plan contracts, understand that the middle broker who sells them insurance and pharmacy plans to their business for their employees is getting paid kickbacks and a massive commission. They can negotiate around that and get a better deal on their health care.
Dr. Marty McCary, thank you so much for your time today.
Great to be with you, Ann.
Dr. Marty McCary, surgical oncologist at Johns Hopkins University. His new book is titled The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. We'll also throw some of those links in that Dr. McCary mentioned as well into our website at WOSU.org/allsides. So check that out. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.